You get to erase one corporate buzzword from existence. Which one are you erasing?
Frothy.
Use it in a sentence, please.
Gosh. The markets are frothy.
I second that. I hate that. Don't ever say that again.
I have a feeling our production team is going to pull that out and use that as a little teaser.
Welcome to Under Embargo, the podcast that says the quiet part out loud about PR, communications, and the chaos in between. Hosted by two of LinkedIn's most connected comms pros, Becca Chambers, a no BS corporate comms exec with raging ADHD, and Parry Hedrick, founder of tech PR firm Crackle PR. This show brings it all. Real talk, sharp insights, and the kind of industry truths they don't put in press releases. No fluff, no filters, no f**ks given. This is Under Embargo. Let's get into it.
Hello, everyone, and thank you to episode 5. We've made it 5 episodes now of the Under Embargo podcast. I am your co-host, Parry Hedrick. I am founder of tech PR agency Crackle PR. My co-host is Becca Chambers. She'll say hello in a hot minute here. She's a CMO of Scale Ventures. And today we are super excited to have Linda Zebian, which I just pronounced correctly, who is the VP of Communications at Muckrack. Welcome, Linda.
Thanks for having me, Pierre and Becca. I'm excited to be here.
That's great. So Linda has a pretty storied career in communication. So in addition to being, I think, the first director of comms at Muckrack, you also had about a decade at the New York Times in various different communications positions, doing a whole bunch of stuff there, which I'll probably ask you to talk through in a minute. And then prior to that, you were at Consumer Reports. So you're no slouch in the comms game. And I'm wondering how Muckrack compares to the other two gigs. So maybe we can just kind of start there.
Yeah, actually, I didn't know what to expect, like moving from media into tech. And I've been so delightfully pleased and surprised by the Muckrack gig. And every day is like better than the next. I actually don't think I've ever been happier at a job. I would say working for a place like the Times, obviously, you've got a lot of like kind of swagger. Right. And Everybody knows what it is. Right. Yeah. Like no one knows what PR is like at Thanksgiving. Right. You're at Thanksgiving and everyone's like, so what do you do? Like even still, it's like it's never going to happen for us. Right. Mom and dad are never going to know, but like they're just never going to get it. I would say, and it was like the honor of my career to work there, of course. But I would say like I've made like the most strides and I'm most proud, I think, of the work I've done at Muckrack in terms of my personal growth and being able to make the most impact on the industry and also to foster growth in people and individuals and to make the most impact on an organization. I think I'm most proud of the work that I've done here. So.
Yeah. Well, you've got a kind of a tall order there, right? Like, so as the first director of comms, I'm imagining that you kind of had to assemble the whole program that you're now in charge of that's growing because Muckrack is in really healthy position, right?
So Tio, because Muckrack is a product for comms people, can we talk about what Muckrack is before we like go keep talking
that's
about
good, that's a good Tio. Good Tio.
So like, please tell us what Muckrack is and then let's continue to talk about Muckrack.
Yeah. Okay. So Muckrack is basically PR software. So this job is like super meta. It's like a super meta job. And I do PR for PR tech platform. And so Muckrack is basically database, traditional and social media monitoring. It's like a team collaboration tool. It's a pitching tool. It's a measurement and reporting tool. And then like there's AI just kind of like threaded throughout. It started, and it's kind of the only one that like does this as a journalist database. So it started 15 years ago. The founders started it. They kind of came out in like the Twitter age. So
I remember when Muck was on the scene. It was a disaster. Yeah.
So they were like noticing that like journalists couldn't find, there was a lot of journalists using Twitter back in the day, and they couldn't find themselves, like each other and like community on Twitter. So they started this database in like less than 2 weeks, they built this database of journalists. And like they were in New York at the time, and like PR people would like stop them and be like, yo, oh, you do Muckrack? Like, this is Greg Gallen and Lee Sumlin, the founders. But like, you know, Greg would be like, you're the Muckrack guy? Like, oh, PR people would be like, oh, we use that to find journalists because it's super accurate, because journalists were wanting to be on it. It was like a thing get on Muckrack.
Yeah.
And so, and they were like, wow, PR people are using this tool, because it was like super accurate. And so they're like, what if we just layered on some like software onto that, some tools onto this database? So they did that, and like kind of like the first iteration of Muckrack came out, and then they just kind of kept adding to it. And then they got some customers, and they just kept adding to it, and they bootstrapped this company for basically like till 2022, which is when they brought me on. And then they got this giant Series A in 2022 for $180 million, which was insane. And it was like 8 months after I started. Anyway, it's a wonderful story. I'm so proud to just
I wanted you to explain, because the meta piece of that is super important and interesting. And I've always said that if I was going to be a marketer, marketing to comms people, man, I would crush it, because like we know ourselves. We're the only people who really know ourselves. So how fun for you that you get to speak to us.
Yeah. Well, like when I took the, when I saw the job, like to leave the Times, it was going to take a lot. I mean, I think the Times was a grueling job. It was 2022. The first Trump administration had left the building, but in that time, it was very difficult to do comms at the New York Times when the sitting president is tweeting at you constantly and questioning the integrity of your brand.
I would never be part of the media.
New York Times. Newspaper.
You're getting it on both sides. You weren't just getting it from the president. You're getting it from everybody.
You're always getting it. When you work at a place like the New York Times, it's like you're too right, you're too left, you don't cover this enough, you don't cover that enough. And like, and I gotta say, like the New York Times, like, you know, having worked there for so long, you know how seriously they take the reporting, and you know how seriously they take independence. And so, and like, you know, Trump, before he took office in the first round, like he came to the building, like he came up to the 15th floor and had a meeting with the publisher and all of those things. So it's like, and it was very complimentary, very kind. And so,
he knows. Yeah.
Right. And so anyway, so like that was grueling. And then with the with COVID and all of that coverage and being in the grind of the news every day, you're almost like, gosh, I kind of need a break from this. And so when I started looking and I saw the Muckrack job, I was like, that could be interesting. And that, and I was very, they proved me very wrong. Like I could do that. Like that could be kind of a softball. Right. But I also thought it would be really interesting to build a team and build out a function. Like what does a PR team at a PR tech company look like? And I've always also been very passionate, I don't know if you see me on LinkedIn, about just like raising the profile of PR people. Obviously, you all are have this podcast and very vocal on LinkedIn as well, in this same vein. We are all into this good fight together, right? We all believe the same things. So I was like, this is really cool. And I could like kind of put my voice, and what I call is get the name onto the thank you email. Like I've had so many people say like, you know, come crying to me, people on my team, like they thanked marketing, they thanked product, they thanked tech, and they're sharing the Wall Street Journal article that
who do they think
secured that article, and like they forgot me, and I'm like, it's okay, like they don't get it, they think it just magically appears, like
yeah, it just magically happens.
Okay, it's actually not okay, but I'm telling you it's okay. And so, you know, it's been like, but you know, I was wrong. You know, clearly, it wasn't like such an easy job. Like working in tech was just an eye opener for me. Like, how dumb was I thinking it was going to be easy to work at like a very fast growing, profitable, kind of disruptor in the industry to be an in-house PR person coming here. And it's just been such a pleasure. And I've actually gotten a chance to influence the product, which has been the coolest part, to see my idea.
What was the idea?
Last year, we launched a PR hit score tool, which basically is almost like a personalized number value you could put on an individual piece of an individual hit. So like, you know, your small trade piece could mean nothing to one company, but it could mean everything and be the biggest hit of the quarter to another company. So you can individualize hits based on also like the value of the journalist, the value of the outlet, the location of the mention. Is it in the headline? Is it in, you know, a pat, like we all, like we've done surveys on this, like number of hits is the number one measure of value in PR outside, like you've got impressions and then you've got like number of pieces of coverage. Yeah. That's your KPI for the quarter. So, so a shitty, sorry, can I say shitty?
Yes.
So a shitty.
Only once.
Okay. So that's just twice.
You're done.
Okay. So a negative mention. Okay. If we're just saying number of mentions is your number one KPI, a negative mention has therefore the same value as a front page story.
Yeah.
If we're talking, a mention among three other competitors has the same value as a profile.
Yeah. I always look at it this way. It's like it reminds me of going to a restaurant and people are like, the restaurant was great. Why was it great? Well, they had huge portions. To me, that is so irrelevant. I want the quality of the meal.
Or the steak was amazing. Well, I'm a vegetarian. Cool. I hate that. Right. That restaurant sucks. But I also think that is a perfect example of, for this campaign, getting in the trades is better than getting in Forbes, right? So like each campaign can have its own set of metrics and goals, and we should be tracking those, not, to your point, these kind of like big whatever metrics that don't tell you anything about what you're actually doing right now to achieve your goals. So I love that.
Yeah, I just think like for too long, we've just like been playing in like these gigantic pools of generic nonsense, and PR is just so specific and nuanced, and every single team and agency, et cetera, just needs specialized metrics and tools, and everything is, and that's why it takes so long. And that's why it's expensive. And that's why, you know, that's just like why, like all the things. And so, and I think that like, it takes time to build technology for this. And we're trying.
I have to say, full disclosure to the listeners here, I am a customer of Muckrack, and happily so. It's been, I think, 3 years now since we switched from another tool that shall remain nameless. But in that time, I can tell you that our team has just been like super pumped about the ability to tailor and customize, to your point, what the metrics are and why they're important. We have back and forth with your team all the time about how to customize certain data sets and different search terms and all of that kind of stuff. So I just think from a usability and efficacy standpoint, what you guys are doing is really cool. You guys are expensive as hell, by the way. I mean, you just are. But I always say, good PR is expensive because it's hard as fuck to do.
Yeah.
So the reason why it costs a lot of money is because it's damn good. So, you know, kudos to that. And I can't anticipate another competitor at this point coming on strong and unseating what you guys have done. It's going to have to be through acquisition, I think, because I don't know how you do that out of the gate.
Can I ask something? Why is PR so hard to measure? And what should people be measuring now, since we shouldn't be just measuring share of voice? Because that's ridiculous.
Yeah. I think PR is hard to measure because like you're essentially measuring brand perception and impact. And it's hard to measure that against, you know, sales and revenue. And so I think, you know, how at least I picture it, not at least how we're trying to think about it, is it's not just one, you can't just do it with one number, or it's a collection, like it's a dashboard. It's a story. And so I always try like to tell folks, like, you're so damn good at telling a story. Like your pitches are solid, and you really have to like continue that long thread of telling the outcome and your impact and your value when you're talking about reporting and measurement. And so that continue your storytelling through on a campaign, right? By using, and it's not just about numbers, it's about your analysis and like the long tail of your impact. And so for us, you know, and I think sentiment is a huge one,
sure,
but it's not there, you know, that's so, and so what we're doing is like really interesting. And I think this is where AI really comes in too. And we have like the best AI team, like speaking to like Perry, what you were saying before about like us just being awesome. We are awesome. And the reason that we're awesome is because we have PR people working here. Like, why wouldn't you hire PR people if you are a tech platform? Like, who do you have building stuff? And like, anyway, so we have like these AI data people that are like just mind blowing. Like I can talk to them and I'm like, I got like 3% of what you just said. They know what they're doing. And so what they're doing is and I don't want to give away like so much, but like I'm talking like, and back to the sentiment thing, sorry, I'm like all over the place because I'm just super hyped.
Okay.
So it's like enriching the data. So the power is in the data, right? Like, and we tell this to our customers all the time. So it's like, and it's so enriching the data in our database, right? So all of the, you know, journalists and the outlets and the podcasts and the newsletters and Substacks and blah, blah. But then like, and also the monitoring as well. So it's like to understand that sentiment, you have to like, not just understand, like, for example, like Apple as a company, but Apple is also a food. So the reason that sentiment is like not
right
or accurate is like you have to take all of the data of the universe of the internet and enrich it, and then also like take another layer of it out to understand the
different context.
Yes, yeah. The context. And so that's what these data engineers are so dang good at. And that's what,
yeah,
we're just like a couple of guys, like,
yeah,
and ladies. And then, but like with AI, you can do that. And so like, that's what they're doing now. And like, I feel like sentiment is the next big thing. And I feel like once we crack that code, then we'll have another layer of measurement and being able to prove the value of, hey, we just saved your ass. Like maybe we didn't get into a crisis, but like, hey, let's measure like what could have happened, but we saved your ass. So pay us more.
Especially if it's real-time sentiment. Because right now, yeah, we measured sentiment and it's very like 3 months ago sentiment, right? Because we're doing surveys and like stuff that takes forever to measure, or we're just like doing a snapshot of social media or whatever. And it's not accurate. Or like you said, it's including random keywords that don't have anything to do with your actual, yeah, company. You know, I work for scale. Like how many things are showing up with scale in it?
You can put an apple on a scale, for example.
So to your point, I totally agree. And I think it's going to be really exciting for me as like a brand person and somebody who is always very frustrated by the lack of ability to really measure brand sentiment and like changing brand sentiment day by day. I think that is a really exciting, you know,
yeah,
change in how AI is going to impact our industry and measurement, because
measurement's
the black box right now.
There's an intelligence piece too. I mean, a lot of this stuff, you know, not to talk smack about analyst groups like the McKinsey's of the world, but you know, those guys are coming to the table with reports that, to your point, Becca, are already pretty stale by the time you pay $1 million for it. And this kind of, you know, instant, always on, fluid, finger on the pulse of the sentiment informs business leaders about how to make changes in real time, you know, based on what they're seeing on the ground today, not 3 months ago. And I think that, yeah, is really ultimately where my watch is talking to me. That's really the power of AI as it relates to these types of tools, I think, is the real time piece of it that is just so lacking. And some of the,
yeah,
the dated legacy stuff.
Yeah. And you know, we're working with this, we just acquired, this company. Sorry, look out the. I'm gonna keep looking out the window because, like, I don't know. There's somebody out there that's like giving me thoughts.
Your dog, by the way, has been trying to get out. So I'm just letting you know.
Oh no, I see him. He's. I think somebody may have delivered a package, and he's just like. He thinks he's way bigger than he is. He's a little pup still. We acquired this Dublin base, but they have a lot of folks over in Bulgaria. They're a media intelligence company in January. Rupoint is the company, and we're integrating their services. So they're like, they have like a lot of proprietary AI features for media intelligence, but they also have like 100 editors and an analyst. And I don't know if you know this, but like Bulgarians are like really good at this kind of stuff. I didn't know this about Bulgarians, but apparently like they all speak like 5 or 6 languages. Had no idea. Smart, really, really smart people. I have no idea. Look at
I did not know that.
I did not know that either. But anyway, like, and I've seen some of their reports, and we're actually getting set up on their platform. We're gonna like drink our own, what do you call that? Drink your own champagne kind of thing. So my team is getting set up on the first, you know, customer zero on the platform. And their services are really interesting because, again, the delay in that it's already stale, right? But what they, you know, they're sending, you can get their reports like throughout the day. These, I mean, it's, again, it's expensive to have managed services. I get it. Sure. But well, who needs this kind of stuff? It's not, you know, small, like little independent
the enterprise,
shops.
Baby.
You're talking about enterprise complex, you yep. know, complex businesses that are global brands. You need it in a language, you need it in a region. Your brand is totally different and, you know, that stuff is really cool, like the media intelligence stuff and what they can do and the analysis that they provide, again, with AI. This is the kind of stuff I love AI for. ChatGPT and like the give me, you know, 5 ways to say this in a gentler way. Sure, great, love it, use it all day. But I don't want to talk about that anymore. I want to talk about the analysis and, you know, like, that's the kind of stuff that I want to talk about with AI and yeah. Also how to use those things to accelerate my, you know, my career, you know, I'm not going anywhere, but you know, like, but that's how we elevate this profession is mm-hmm. to do what marketing did, you know, X amount of years ago and push. I think the seat is getting pushed way more than it ever has. But I'd love to see it accelerate at a faster rate.
This is an interesting potential segue. So one of the things that I think you and I talked on LinkedIn briefly about was a report that you guys were involved with talking about journalists and mental health yeah. and the surprising data that came out of that. And we were just talking about AI. So the transition really is, you know, AI is eating a lot of people's lunch, some of which is the reporter, the journalist. Going up against these, you know, automated systems now, basically. So I'm just wondering what you're seeing from your seat as, you know, right in the middle of the zeitgeist of both the PR world, the journalists, because they're in your database. Like, what are you seeing happening with journalism vis-a-vis AI and just shrinking newsrooms and ad dollars drying up? Like, what's the view from your seat?
Yeah. So we have a state of journalism. So we have like a number of reports that come out every year. Like we have a state of AI and PR. We have a state of journalism. The survey's out in the field right now. Obviously, local news continues to be super duper challenged. We just came out with a state of work life balance in journalism, which is I think the scariest one for me because like almost half or over half of journalists have left a job or have considered leaving a job or leaving journalism. I got to get the right data. Considered leaving journalism in the next year.
Yeah.
Wow. Wild.
That was the factoid that really caught my eyes. Like, what?
Mind blowing.
Yeah. Not surprised.
I have journalists DMing me all the time looking to join with my PR agency. I mean, all the time. And so I'm seeing it in real time, but you know, that's just anecdotal, like people coming to me, but it seems that people who are in that profession for the most part, unless you're really highly paid at a great organization, are looking for the exit signs.
Yeah. And they're not highly paid. I think it's 70K is the average. And I think it's like, and then you look at the tenure and it just literally, the line is like 70K, 70K, 70, yeah. It's like 25 years plus in journalism, 70K.
Well, and then you look at the fact that I think the last thing I saw was there's 7-1 PR people to reporters in this world, 7-1. So they're getting hammered with pitches from literally everywhere. And every one of these PR people is making more than that 70K pretty much. I mean, they're, you know, at 70K, 120K, 150K.
Yeah.
Peppering these reporters who are working their butts off for
small
dollars, man. It's something has got to give, right?
Yeah. And I don't know what that something is.
AI, isn't it? Because AI is going to exacerbate the problem, not improve it.
Exactly. And I think the problem is like these smaller, I think for like a while there was like too many outlets. It's like, oh, the Voxes and the Vices and the BuzzFeeds. And it was like, oh my gosh, there's so much competition now. And it's like, where do you go for eyeballs? And nobody wants to pay for news anymore. No one's going down to the newsstand. No one's subscribing to magazines. The magazines were getting eaten up and the you know, the fangs and the advertising dollars. And the advertising dollars never came back. They're never coming back. Right. So that was my job at the Times, was basically on the business side, is to like draw attention to why people should pay for news, why people should subscribe to and pay for and support independent news. I think like no one's really worrying about the New York Times and subscriptions and the New York Times not being here in 10 years, right? Or the Wall Street Journal not being here in 10 years, or ABC Nightly News or whatever. Like, okay. But it's like diversity of points of view and diversity of voices. And like, what about that? You know what I mean? And independent newsrooms, it's going to be like crazy lefts and crazy rights. And like, what about everybody else? And who's supporting like alternative newsrooms or alternative weeklies and local newsrooms? And who's covering like local governments? And who's keeping the powers that be in check? And who's supporting, independent sort of nonpartisan news or government funded news.
I'm seeing a lot of movement on Substack and similar platforms.
Exactly. Like
people are taking it upon themselves to build their own platforms.
Yeah.
And they're monetizing themselves. I mean, they're betting on themselves, monetizing themselves and getting advertisers for themselves. But they tend to be the people who are already trusted reporters and trusted journalists and have that halo effect before they did. And I guess that's really the key to be successful, is having that recognition before you decide to hang your own Substack shingle.
Sure. And I think all that's fine and well, I guess, for PR people, like that's fine and well. And I guess for a model, but I think like if you kind of zoom out, and this is kind of what I care about, it may not be like a PR topic. It may be more of like a democratic topic, is like, okay, people will pay for news that interests them and topics that interest them, but like, they're still only hearing and watching and listening and reading to things that share their same opinion. So I will pay for this because I believe in it and that's what I want to hear. And so are we all just going to be like just going deeper into the ecosystem of things and tailored ideas that we only want to hear? Like, how do we get out of that ecosystem of, you know, being in the feed of similar values and thoughts and not really sharing in diversity of thought and only watching cable news that we want to hear? And, you know, I think at the Times they grappled with that, you know.
I almost think we're going to see like what happened with cable TV, which is it went from everybody watching the like six channels and getting sick of it to it fragmenting into a bajillion different digital streaming services, to now everyone being like, there are too many digital streaming services. And now they're starting to like regroup, or like at least you can buy a digital streaming, you know, you can buy Disney, but you also get blah 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 blah. Like maybe that's how it's going to become, because to your point, I'm not going to pay for 19 Substack subscriptions just to get my news. Like at some point I'm going to need to just get news. And
it's kind of funny, like just to go a little bit deeper into the like, you know, the hard right, the hard left, people reaffirming their own beliefs in these things. Like the algorithms have essentially, you know, trained people to do that, right? So whether it's TikTok, whether it's Instagram, whether it's Facebook, if you start liking and engaging with certain content, then the algorithm feeds you more of that content. So you never can leave the echo chamber, essentially. And so people have hungered for that across their entire lives. And so that's why they gravitate toward the Fox News on the extreme right, the MSNBCs and the extreme left, and then CNN, a couple of people like NPR's twisting in the middle, trying to play it, you know, balls and strikes. But I think what ultimately has to happen, Linda and Becca, is that there's got to be some big pocketed billionaires like the Mark Cubans of the world, like the Reid Hoffmans of the world, people who are very, very wealthy and also very, very outspoken to get together and create a new model at the highest level.
I love that we're in the billionaires will save us. The billionaires can save us now.
They're either going to kill us or they're going to save us. One of the two.
The billionaires are going to kill us, so only the billionaires can save us. Like, that's where we are. We are all the minions just sitting around like, billionaires, please come and help us.
Choose your fighter.
Oh my God. How did we get to this place? Billionaires, please help us. Give us a little bit of help. Oh my God. Yikes. But you're right. I mean, you're right. I think about this all the time. Mark Cuban is a sane, rational voice. And I don't think I would have said 15 years ago that Mark Cuban is going to be the savior of the left, because I don't necessarily think he is. I just think he is sane and rational right now in a moment when there is not a lot of sanity being spewed. And I do wish that somebody like him, like what he's doing with prescription drugs, can he just do that with all things, where he's just taking the practical human-centric approach, which is, I'm going to make this affordable because it's the right thing to do. And it doesn't, I'm not taking a financial hit on it. I'm still making a profit and it's good for humanity. Win, win, win. Oh my God. Imagine that.
Mm-hmm. Imagine that indeed. Well, it's a complicated world we live in. And anytime you're talking about the media landscape now, you necessarily have to confront the forces that are trying to manipulate things. I mean, look at the Washington Post. Look at Jeff Bezos, basically, you know, rolling over and doing the bidding of people that he would not normally be in bed with, right? I mean, the Los Angeles Times. I mean, there's all kinds of publications that are supplicant to you know, forces that they normally wouldn't even dream of getting in bed with. And that's the unfortunate reality of where we are.
Well, and a few years ago, us having a PR podcast wouldn't have meant that every single episode led to a political discussion, but they are unlinkable at this point, because the media and politics are so like intertwined in a way, and tech, right? Like all of it is just now like so intertwined in such a way that it like, you can't have a conversation about one without the other things coming into it. And I think it's fascinating. Every single day I go to work, you know, there are conversations about politics coming in, and people are always like, oh, you shouldn't talk about politics on LinkedIn. And it's like, it's everywhere all the time. It permeates mm-hmm. all the things. So fascinating.
Yeah, indeed. And I know, Linda, you probably don't want to go deep into the politics rat hole. So we can pivot away from that a little bit.
Let's do that.
I have a question that is a totally different pivot. And I see on your LinkedIn that you are a guest lecturer at a number of places. And I'm curious what you guest lecture about.
I love guest lecturing. I love talking to students, and I probably do it too much, and I don't have time.
That's something I would love to do that I've never done.
I should connect you with some folks. Gosh, everything, career development, pitching. I share a lot of Muckrack's research, because that's a great topic that they like are super interested in. Like, we used to do a salary report that they love to like, oh my gosh, how much am I going to make? You know, how much do I expect to make out of college? You know, crisis comms, media training. I mean, all the stuff. Yeah. Love it. Love to talk to students. You know, some of them are like so engaged, and then some of them are like hoodie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, wake up. I'll be like, wake up. Do you know what this opportunity is? Come on.
Seriously. I've done the thing where like, what is it? We're basically like a cohort of kids in a PR class, like did a project for me and my team. So like I worked with them and like, and then they presented it to me, and it was like so awesome. And, you know, I got a lot out of it. They got a lot out of it. And some of them were just like the most, you could tell who were the like real doers on the team and who were just pulling up the rear. And some of them I was like, I would hire those kids in an instant. Anyway, I would just like love to do more of that, where it's not quite as intensive as having like a full semester long project, but yes.
I'll connect you with some friends of mine. I also do the judging for the PRSA Apple.
Love it.
I love that. I love to see the creativity from the agencies. I'm like, y'all go get them. Because I haven't worked agency in so long. I just love that vibe. I love the vibes. I love it. So good.
I do think that there is something to when you're around the people who have the like the hunger and the excitement for their job, you know, and you're just around like the people who just like want to get it and like they've got the ideas and they have the desire to just like, I don't know how to do this, but I'm just going to go figure it out. Like that is the best. And I feel like when you're
fearless
around those people, it like fires you up to get everything going.
I've done a bunch of those lecture type things to comms classes and stuff. And I like it too. The one thing that I would say, like they always ask for like, what advice would you give, you know, students like us going out into the real world? And honestly, the advice I'm giving now is less to do with communications, less to do with like, make sure you read a lot, make sure, you know, it's more like, make sure you're the smartest person in your new organization about AI and how it affects your job, no matter what that job is going to be. Because if you can walk into a room and give people relief that you are the one that knows what the hell you're talking about AI, you're going to have a steady career. And that's truly the best advice I could think of right now, given the backdrop of where we're at. I tell my kids all the time, like in your spare time, use AI and build things, tweak things, like just get super, freak us out about what kind of things you can do with AI. And that's going to be the best training ground for you as you start to, you know, venture out into the workforce.
Just test new tools all the time. Like I have a note that's called AI to try. And anytime I see somebody doing something cool, I just like add the AI name to my list. And then when I have 20 minutes, I just go dabble with it. And now I'm sure I'm paying like 1,000 once upon a time were free subscriptions that I forgot to cancel that are like rolling over at $20 a month. But I've tried like a million AI and some of them are amazing. And if I had more time, I'm sure I could do 1,000 things in my life. But like, I know how to video edit now, thanks to AI tools that I wouldn't have been able to do a year ago. And to Perry's point, imagine what your kids can learn how to do now, you know?
See, this like, isn't even me. I'm actually just an avatar. You guys don't even know that. Yeah, that's what I built.
He's sleeping.
Jealous.
So we have about 10 minutes left. I mean, I think we might have to turn over into rapid fire land.
Rapid fire always turns into like more than rapid fire because we end up like segueing ourselves. But all right, I've got the rapid fire question. So
Do I have to also answer, like you ask rapid fire and I answer rapid fire?
That's correct. I ask, you answer.
I mean, you don't have to be extremely quick with your answer, but the idea is that these are little quick and dirty Q&A's.
And we ask everybody, so, you know,
got it. Perspective.
I'm going to let Perry ask the last one because it's Perry's question, but I'll ask the same questions.
Okay.
What is a myth or misconception about communication that drives you crazy? Oh, did you hear that? Is that me?
I don't know. Like a motorcycle.
Did you hear something?
Oh, that's the leaf floor. Sorry. He walked
away. I just want to make sure I wasn't crazy that I was like,
hearing. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
What's a myth or misconception about communications that drives you crazy?
That we're not analytical.
Same.
I'm not analytical, but other folks are. That work in comms.
But like, you're analytical enough to know that like one size doesn't fit all to report something, right?
Yeah. Actually, my boss came in. She's CMO, and I met her on the first day, and I was like, you know, I've never worked in marketing before, but like, you know, or I'm not a marketer. I said to her, and she like lost her dang mind on me. She's like, "What do you mean you're not a marketer?" Not really like that, but she's like, "You are a marketer." She's the literally the greatest human ever. Okay, go.
I'm with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd yell at you too.
Yeah.
Okay. You get to erase one corporate buzzword from existence. Which one are you erasing?
Frothy.
Use it in a sentence, please.
The markets are frothy.
I second that. I hate that. Don't ever say that again.
I have a feeling our production team is going to pull that out and use that as a little teaser. Frothy. The markets are frothy.
It's the worst.
Okay. I just asked this one on LinkedIn the other day. You are about to give a presentation in front of 50,000 people at an arena. You're going to walk out on stage. What is your walkout song?
Oh, I just walked out to this at our All Hands when we were all together at a big retreat, company retreat in February. Calm Down by Selena Gomez.
All right, there you go.
Everybody needs to calm the hell down.
Everybody needs to calm the hell down.
Yeah.
Well, you are not wrong.
Serious. It's not that serious. Yeah.
All right.
Love now, these questions.
Is it me or is there still more?
There's more. There's two more before you, Perry.
Okay. I'll be patient.
If you had to do a TED Talk on anything but communications, what would your topic be?
Probably spirituality, faith, empathy, and humanity.
I would
very light topics.
I would sit through that though. That sounds fascinating. Let me know when you're giving that talk. I'm here for
okay.
it. And yeah, like a little light afternoon spirituality. Yeah.
It's all good. It's all love. It's all love.
We need a little bit of humanity in our lives.
Yeah.
Okay. My last question for you is you get to use one emoji for the rest of your life. Which one? Only one.
Oh, goodness. The one I use the most is the heart, but the one I like the most is the melting face.
I was just going to say melting face. Melting face is my favorite. It's like the new eye roll. It has it conveys so much, right?
It's just deflated.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I love a melty face. I'm with you. Excellent choice. All right, Perry. Last question.
Yeah, so here comes the best question of all. This is super exciting. Super exciting. Yeah. So you have a choice. You can either have hiccups around the clock, hiccups for 3 months, 3 months straight, no relief, no break, even when you're sleeping, when you're eating, 3 months. Or you cannot have hiccups, but you have to chop off your pinky. What do you choose?
Oh, totally. Like chop off the pinky forever.
Yeah. Hiccups nonstop.
No, I think I go with the hiccups. Yeah.
You keep the hiccups?
Yeah, I would.
Yeah.
Because you really need your pinky to have balance and do like handstands and stuff. So, and I do yoga. So
the spirituality comes into play.
Yeah. You really need a pinky.
You can't do hiccups with yoga though.
Yeah. But I could give up yoga for 3 months. Yeah.
I think it's a personal challenge to balance without a pinky. That sounds more like.
I have never heard the answer that you need your pinky to do handstands. That is pretty amazing.
Well, yeah. And like you probably need it to like hold a racket and like that would be like, plus it's like temporary versus permanent.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so with you. Linda, you would be shocked at how many people would choose to lop off their pinky, including Becca. She's
really. I mean, I considered it. But then like practicality of it, and also like you could probably like maybe take a med to like you can't cope with the hiccups by like
taking
some like really
sedative. An angry diaphragm. I say this on every show, so the people who watch all of our shows are probably like, dear God, Becca with the hiccup rants.
All right, here's a bonus question. Ready? You can have $100 million right now given to you, but you will die by being eaten by a shark at the age of 95. What do you choose?
for sure get eaten by a shark at 95.
You would get eaten by a shark at 95.
No.
100%. Getting eaten by a shark is not the worst way to die. There are way worse ways to die.
Getting eaten by a shark?
Yeah, there are worse ways to die.
What could be worse?
Getting hit by a car might be worse.
No way, that's instant. Getting eaten by a shark is like tragic and slow and drowning.
Not necessarily. Get just bit right in half, you die pretty quick.
I could think of worse ways to die than, getting eaten by a shark.
95, you know that you're going to live a nice long life.
Well, that is the one perk, is that you know you live to 95.
Fallen with 100 mil?
Perry, lower the age.
All right, we're going with 88.
I think I'd still go for it.
See, I wouldn't do it.
I would not be able to live a single relaxing moment for the rest of my life, knowing that some point I'm going to be eaten by a shark. Like that would be my all-consuming thought everywhere I went, everything I did. I'd be mid-conversation at a party being like, oh my God, I'm going to get eaten by a shark at some point.
Do you two not live with an anxiety disorder? Because I live every day worried I'm going to die every single day. So knowing I'm going to live until 88 would be a fucking godsend. Come on now. I don't even need the 100 million. Just knowing I'm going to live to be 88. Woohoo!
It's like a panacea for you.
I really love that. I'm still no. I mean, if I knew the exact
day it was gonna happen, for sure, because then I would just like take all the drugs, we'd have a big party, and we'd just swim out to sea and peace out, grandma.
Oh my God, this is take highly disturbing, but I love it.
Take my mind. All right,
and well,
that
any I final thoughts, Linda, any final things that we didn't cover that you think would be important for our listeners to hear?
Yes, Becca and I are going on a boat trip. And no, I'm kidding.
You're bringing an apple and a scale.
Perfect. And drugs, apparently. And shark bait.
And only four fingers each.
Wow. Big plans, guys.
All right.
Linda, well, it was lovely.
This has been a lot of fun, Linda. Thank you for indulging.
This was so fun. This was the most funnest podcast LinkedIn thingy I've ever done. So
under embargo, the most funnest.
It's tell most your friends. Funnest.
I will tell my friends. I'm going to share the crap out of this. Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Awesome. Well, to that point, we'll give you some resources and things like that. So don't you worry. It was great having you on. I really appreciate it. Big fan of Muckrack, and now I'm a big fan of yours.
Thank you. Likewise.
All right.
Thanks.